The Senate Judiciary Committee will come to order. Let it the record reflect that we do have a quorum present. Members, welcome back. We've had a couple of informational hearings or joint informational hearings, but today is basically sort of the first day that we're having a hearing on some substantive bills, so I appreciate you being here. You will see in your folders that we have an agenda for the day, but we're moving Senator Murphy up. He's feeling a little bit under the weather, and we want to get him finished and get on his way. So, Senator Murphy, welcome to the committee. Senator Murphy will be presenting Senate File 42.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Madam Chairman and members, Senate File 42 is the bill that we heard last year in regards to primary seatbelt legislation. We all know that traffic crashes is the number one leading cause of death from birth to the age 33. Teen drivers are disproportionately high amongst those fatality rates. Teen drivers represent about 6% of the overall driving population, but are involved in 12% of all the fatal crashes, twice of what their allotment should be. Lieutenant Peterson is here today to show us a video, and Commissioner Campion is from the Department of Public Safety is also here to provide testimony and talk a little bit about what you're going to see on this video. I'm going to warn you, this video is pretty graphic, so... It's pretty graphic, but the State Patrol put this together under Lieutenant Peterson's direction, and they did a wonderful job. And I think that every teen driver in the state should see this video, and every person who's thinking about getting a driver's license should be required to watch this video. And members, there's... I believe there's going to be an amendment offered by Senator Scheid here when we're done with the presentation. And I'm just perfectly fine with Senator Scheid's amendment, as is the State Patrol and other law enforcement. So with that, I'll let Commissioner Campion speak.
Commissioner Campion, welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, thank you for the opportunity. Michael Campion is my name. I'm the Commissioner of Public Safety. We will use a very little amount of your time. Will be effective and efficient. I'd like to thank the chair and also the author of this bill and the Senate, the entire Senate, for their continued support of traffic safety, 0.08 legislation, graduated driver's license. All those actions, Madam Chair and members, certainly have saved lives on the highways of the state of Minnesota. We'll do two things today. I will show you a videotape. I'll make a couple comments before it. And then I have a few comments after that. Very proud of the Minnesota State.
Can you hang on a second? Can we please take the conversations outside? It's very hard to hear in the hearing room today. Thank you very much. Commissioner.
Very proud of the Minnesota State Patrol. They put this video together. They didn't come to the legislature or ask for any money. They did it on their own. They saw a need, and they fulfilled it. And I'm really very proud of their accomplishments. The video is 15 minutes in length. It shows four traffic tragedies here in the state of Minnesota. Everything on the video is real, and it, as Senator Murphy said, it is graphic. There are body parts that are shown and so forth. These tragedies are what your law enforcement people that work in the communities you represent deal with really on a regular basis. The video very well may have some people feel uncomfortable. This video was not designed for us, for adults. It is designed for a specific demographic, and that is young drivers under the age of, say, 29 and people who are first starting out driving. What I would ask you to do is envision that you would be sitting watching this video with your young driver, your son or daughter or granddaughter or cousin, niece or nephew, and trying to let them absorb the message that is intended with this video. We haven't shown this video without law enforcement giving an introduction. It's not something that you just would show randomly to anybody, and particularly young children. But the response up to now has been very positive, very sobering, and parents in particular have been very enthusiastic about what is messaged here in this video. With that, I'd ask Lieutenant to Peterson to show the video. And if you wouldn't mind, Madam Chair, if those people are on this side of the hearing room wanted to go to the other side so they could see it, would you have any objection to that?
Not at all. Please feel free to move, you know, to this side of the room to see.
If you don't take the job of driving seriously, the consequences can be tragic. The following video shows the results of traffic crashes in Minnesota caused by drivers who are not paying attention or who made poor decisions. It illustrates life and death, and how the decisions you make impact not only yourself, but also those around you. Lives can change in a fraction of a second based on your choices. Please consider the message. Decided to go to Hastings and along County Road 46. Decided to drive out there. I was driving a 2000 Lincoln LS. And I was driving. And it was great, obviously. I guess the road was real icy. I don't really remember too much of what happened. But I guess the road was real icy. And I lost control of my car and went down the ditch and I hit a culvert and launched my car into the air and hit a tree about 6 feet up of the tree and took the tree out and the tree fell on top of my car and killed my friend that was in the car with me and broke my back and that punctured a lung, lacerated my spleen and liver, was knocked out for probably 3 days, and over to the hospital with a broken back. My mom gave me, and that's all for me for what had happened to my family. She said, you were the owner of the car. And I didn't really remember who was with me, you know, so she told me that it was my friend Josh, and he was sometimes just put into the front. If you can't do it, all these people realize. This way, it's just a
very violent. It's not where it's like, don't drink and drive, don't take the chance. You never know. You never know what could happen. You could make it home safely 1,000 times, but it's just that one time that can change your life forever. Just don't do it. It's not worth it.
To see the car was probably the worst for me because I felt I could experience what she really went through. Just seeing all the dents in the car made me realize like how much pain she could have been in, and I just broke down when I saw the car. It changed all of our lives by forcing me to grow up, and it changed my parents' life because now they worry about wherever I go and who I'm with, and I have to call my parents whenever I get to a certain place. Whenever I'm in the car with somebody and they're not wearing their seatbelt, I tell them they should. Whenever somebody's in my car, I make it a rule that they have to wear a seatbelt. Makes me feel good knowing that what happened to us has helped others not make the same mistake as my sister did. I want kids to take away from this that drinking and driving is very bad and it can ruin many lives, and not wearing a seatbelt and texting while you are driving can be very dangerous. It makes me sad knowing that I'm going to hang out with my sister and go shopping with her again.
Sunny days seem to hurt the most. Wear the pain like a heavy coat. I feel you everywhere I go. I see your smile, I see your face. I hear you laughing in the rain. I still can't believe you're gone. It ain't fading out too young, like the story that hadn't just begun. But death tore the pages all away. God knows how I miss you. All the hell that I've been through, just know no one can take your place. Sometimes I wonder if who you'd be today.
They didn't make it home. I went around the corner, and I can't remember too much about it, but it's a 90-degree corner, and I just went straight and hit the big tree. I don't remember anybody telling me that they were dead. It was just my hospital room door opened up, and everybody just came into my room, and everybody was crying, and I don't remember anybody telling me specifically that they were dead. I think I already knew. it was so hard for me to see all those pictures of them. It was, like I said, I can't really tell my emotions. I don't know how to do it, but I mean, guilt, sad. I was so sad. I mean, I don't think I ever cried that much. It was insane to see, like you said, the whole thing, the dreams that they had for them. It's like, what could they have been? Doctors, lawyers, you know, multimillionaires? Like, what could they have been? And no one will ever know, because their life got taken. I was placed in jail for 2 years at the Ramsey County Workhouse. I am on 23 years of probation. I don't have a driver's license until 2016. I have to pay $8,000 of restitution. I have probably $1,000 worth of court fees, $900 worth of probation fees. I have my lawyer fees. I have to pay my dad back my $10,000 on the bail. Wearing a seatbelt would definitely make a difference in their lives. They would have been alive, I'm sure. When you're gone, the pieces of my heart are missing you. When you're gone, I was with my sister and her friend driving home from a movie. At 9 in the evening, my car slid into the path of an oncoming truck who T-boned me, critically injuring all three of us. And originally, the paramedics thought that they'd only be able to keep us alive long enough to donate my organs, because I wasn't going to make it, because my skull, eye socket, cheek, and jaw were severely crushed. It really hit me when I got home and I walked upstairs, and the bedroom right next to my bedroom was my sister's bedroom, and it was empty. And that was really the killer. My skull is now put together with titanium. My left side is not as strong as my right side, and I've had to work very hard through physical therapy sessions to re-strengthen it. My left eye does not blink, and being hit on the right side, nerves were injured on my left side. So my left eye doesn't blink, and it doesn't look up or down, and actually I can't smell. For Angie and I, because we were wearing seatbelts, we're alive today. And they had to cut us out of the seatbelts to get us out, which is a good thing to know that we would be dead right now if it had not been for the seatbelts we were wearing. I think a lot of kids today don't wear seatbelts because it's not as cool, or you're relying on something other than yourself for safety. And it's kind of a pride issue. And kids need to realize it's not about being cool or being tough. It's about your life. Before, I thought, you know, car accidents happen to people who drink and drive. People who are messing with MP3 players or CD players, fiddling with a radio, with, you know, 5 kids bouncing around in the back. And thought, that's not going to happen to me because I'm a good driver. But car crashes can happen to anyone. My hope is that you may be able to see this and see that I'm just like any of you guys. And you could be driving home any day and slide, or have someone slide into your lane. And do what you can and prevent that from happening, because it's not worth your life.
Troopers and law enforcement officers are saving lives every day on Minnesota's roadways. By obeying these 4 simple rules, you too can save a life. Pay attention. Driver inattention or distraction is a leading cause of crashes in Minnesota. Drive the speed limit. Illegal or unsafe speed is the second leading cause of crashes in our state. Additionally, when the weather is bad, snow, ice, or rain, ride according to the conditions. Never drink and drive. Drinking and driving can account for one-third of all fatal crashes. Fourth, when you're in your car, wear your seatbelt. By using these four simple rules, you too can save a life.
It's not my time. I'm not good.
Madam Chair, members, each death on this video was prevented, is preventable. These are human tragedies. These fatalities aren't just simple bureaucratic statistics. These are tragedies that severely affect families and extended families. The Minnesota State Patrol's primary responsibility is traffic safety throughout the state of Minnesota. I asked Colonel Donansky the other day, what's the worst job, what's the worst responsibility that a state trooper has? And of course, most people would think could come upon a tragedy where people are killed. The worst part of a state trooper's job is to go to that home and deliver that death notice to a mother or father or a husband or wife and to inform somebody that, in fact, their loved one is dead due to a car accident. Now, we can never prevent or eliminate all car crashes. We'll never be able to do that. But what we really can do and what is within our grasp is to reduce the number of fatalities and the number of serious life-altering crashes that occur in Minnesota. And we do know, as a community, a traffic safety community, what does work. In 2008, we had in Minnesota the lowest traffic fatality rate in Minnesota since 1944. I'll say that again. The lowest traffic fatality rate in the state of Minnesota in 2008 since 1944. Now, there were a number of reasons for it. Some of it were gas prices. Some of it were people were driving less. People were driving the speed limit more often because of the high price of gas. But education, enforcement, safer highways, safer vehicles, and enhanced medical response all contributed to that. And we collectively have collected data around the country, and we do know from the experience of other states and other really strong empirical studies what does work. And here are some key points that I would offer to you. Most Minnesotans wear their seatbelt. We're at an 87% compliance rate. That means 13% don't wear it. So that 13% amounts to about 700,000 drivers in the state of Minnesota at any given time that are not wearing their seatbelt. That 13% accounts for about 200 deaths and about 400 serious life-altering crashes a year. The demographics are as follows. Young teenagers up to the age of 29, most of them male, and most of them in greater Minnesota. Teens in that demographic are approximately 25% of the licensed drivers, yet they are close to 50% of the unbuckled, unbelted drivers that die in car crashes. So they're significantly, disproportionately represented in automobile crashes, in deaths, and also in automobile life-altering crashes. If you don't wear a seatbelt and you get in a car crash, your medical bills are going to be at least 50% higher than if you would not have. By most data, most statistics, most other states, Minnesota will save approximately $25 million in hospital charges the first year if we pass a primary seatbelt law. And that doesn't include the long-term care, what it costs to keep somebody in a nursing home or in a hospital 2, 3, or 4 years after the first year. Most important, though, the national studies indicate that passing a primary seatbelt will increase compliance somewhere, probably in Minnesota, 7, 8 to 9%. There's 26 other states that have passed primary seatbelt legislation. In Minnesota, that will equate to approximately 30 lives a year that will not be lost and approximately 400 life-altering crashes that will not take place. By all accounts, a primary seatbelt law will increase the compliance, especially under that demographics of that I described, those young people between late teens until the late 20s, 28, 29 years old. In summation, I would just offer two very quick thoughts. Legislators oftentimes have an option or a a decision to make between a couple of pieces of legislation that maybe everyone would agree on. You might have a piece of legislation that is very good, but it costs too much money. You might pass this legislation, you may have to take money away from education or transportation or some other very important other legislative priority. I offer that the passage of primary seatbelt will save 30 lives, 400 life-altering crashes in the course of a year, reduce medical costs by $25 million in the first year by other people's statistics, not ours. Two-thirds of the people in Minnesota polled said that they agree that primary seatbelt should be a primary offense. 87% of the driving public already complies with it. We will receive in the state of Minnesota $3.5 million for traffic-related safety features, and that means putting barriers in two-way highways and so forth. And for the same reason that a lot of people in the legislature and House have said voted for graduated driver's license, in that law focused in on the largest demographics or the demographics that are most susceptible, and that is those young teens. The primary seatbelt law isn't for you folks and for us. It's for those young people that really are disproportionately impacted by traffic crashes. All of this with a fiscal note that doesn't cost any money. There is no money that is required to pass a primary seatbelt law, yet we will gain those aspects that I've already outlined. So there isn't a choice between one piece of legislation and another that may cost money. This doesn't cost any. With that, Madam Chair and members, I appreciate the time.
Thank you, Commissioner Campion, and thank you, Senator Murphy. Are there any questions for Senator Murphy on the language of the bill?
No.
Senator Scheid?
Madam Chair, I think Mr. Backus would make offer an amendment, and it is, I think it's oral. And my concern has been, and it may not be exactly what Senator Murphy has seen, but I think Mr. Backus and I think it agree. So I'd like to move the language that I think he will read for you. Concerns people who deliver newspapers and the fact that they are either stopping and starting a lot, getting out of the car, or they're reaching across themselves to put newspapers in mailboxes or, the newspaper tube kinds of things. And it's just impractical. It means that, when they're going to their job, they'd have to be wearing their seatbelt. But while they're doing that activity, they would not have to have a seatbelt on. And I don't know what the numbers are between, like, say, 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning till 6:30 or 7 in the morning. That's when they're on the road.
Senator Scheid moves the following amendment that will be read by Mr. Backus. Mr. Backus?
Madam Chair and members, it would be on page 2, line 25, after service, insert, or a newspaper delivery person.
Mr. Backus, could you repeat that, please?
Madam Chair and members, page 2, line 25, after service, insert, or a newspaper delivery person.
Senator Scheid, is that your amendment?
Madam Chair, yes.
Senator Murphy is okay with that amendment. Any discussions on Senator Scheid's amendment? Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Scheid, I understand what you're trying to do. I'm just thinking of other delivery type drivers that might be doing the same thing, but defining it as a newspaper delivery person may miss those people. You've got people that deliver simple advertisements to an advertising delivery service, ADS ads. They've got the little black magazine tubes that hang underneath mailboxes. They're not a newspaper delivery person. They deliver advertising. So you're covering strictly delivery people, newspaper delivery only. And I don't know, could tell me, the guy who drives the Schwann's truck, are they required to have a seatbelt, or a FedEx, or a whoever else, a variety of delivery
look right above
personal
this.
personnel might be involved.
Senator Murphy.
Well, Madam Chair and Senator Limmer, I'm not exactly sure about SWANs, but I know that UPS requires their drivers to be belted anytime their vehicle is in motion.
All right.
Mr. Backus, is there a general exception in the statute or?
Madam Chair and members, if you look at Section 3 on page 2, that contains all the exemptions. And you may want to look at that Clause 4 beginning on line 22.
I see.
It's a general exception, but, of course, you'd have to fall within those parameters that are described there.
Right.
Senator Limmer?
I'm just bringing it up for discussion, Madam Chair. I don't have any legislation.
Senator Higgins?
Madam Chair, I'm looking at Clause 7 in that same section, which is somebody riding or driving in a pickup truck while engaged in normal farming work or activity. The farm I grew up on, to get to the back field, you had to go out onto the road, down to the corner, take a left, and then into the lane. Would that mean that we would not have had to put the seatbelt on when we were going out onto the highway? I'm not sure. When I grew up, there were seatbelts in the vehicles. So
it's that long ago, Senator Higgins.
You're not that old.
You can tell us how old that story is.
You just were driving old cars.
Well, that too.
Senator Murphy?
Well, I understand what Senator Higgins is getting after there. I believe that maybe the commissioner can speak more clearly to this, but anytime that pickup truck is on a state trunk highway, you're not engaged in farming activity. Once you get back on the town road or the dirt road in between fields, in my opinion, you're engaged.
Okay.
I mean, one of the troopers or somebody could clarify that with you later, but
yeah.
You know, they didn't have seatbelts when I started driving either. And, you know, most of the time you had to kind of run it with your feet.
Yeah. Madam Chair, Senator Murphy, we looked out the big hole in the bottom of the pickup truck. It had rusted out. It was that old a truck, like Senator Limmer said.
Commissioner Campion, I would assume that whenever a vehicle is on the public roadway, and if our troopers were to see that, or if they pull somebody over, and if they were to say, I'm engaging in farming activities, that certainly would not be an excuse.
Madam Chair, I would think that you're correct. The intent there is public highways and probably not in the backfields of a farm, but that would be my interpretation.
Thank you. Senator Murphy, just a couple of items. I think that there are some minor changes in the bill from from last year, or just to make sure that we've clarified in the members' minds. I know that in Section 1 of the bills, there is a $25 fine for the driver. Mm-hmm. And any passenger under the age of 15, correct?
Yeah. Right, Madam Chair. And the driver of the vehicle who's supposed to be responsible gets all of those tickets. So
that's right.
If you're driving down the road and you got six 14-year-old kids unbelted playing around in the back end and you get pulled over, you're going to get seven $25 fines.
And Senator Murphy, if now all the passengers were adults, then the driver gets his own $25, but all the other adults in the vehicle get their own $25.
Exactly.
Is that correct?
Tickies.
And then, Senator Murphy, there's also a $25 surcharge that is assessed. If all the four individuals in the vehicle, including the driver, were grown-ups, they would each get assessed a $25 surcharge?
Yes.
And Senator Murphy, I also understand that though there is a provision that says in the instance where it's the driver and maybe four minors, that the driver, while he is or she is on the hook for the $25 fees, would only be assessed one surcharge.
Correct.
Is that correct?
Madam Chair?
Senator Higgins.
We haven't voted on Senator Scheid's amendment yet.
Oh, that's true. I apologize. We got distracted.
I just thought you might be talking to my amendment, but I was getting farther away from it in my head. So.
Thank you very much for reminding me. So we do have Senator Scheid's amendment on the table for discussion. Any further discussions on Senator Scheid's amendment?
Where is it?
Senator Foley on Senator Scheid's amendment?
Yes, Madam Chair. I would speak in opposition to that amendment. I don't think that that furthers the cause of safety, and and when we get to the $25 fine, I want to speak to that same issue. But committee members, look at this and look at what's been going on for years and years. I can remember getting involved in seatbelt enforcement before we had seatbelt in the squads. And I will say this, that I firmly believe that we can and should make it safe for motorists in the state of Minnesota, include the passengers and all, to make exemptions for mail and newspaper and other types of gears. Just doesn't make good safety sense. And I therefore am voting against
it. Seeing no further discussions in Senator Scheid's amendment, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay.
Nay.
Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Any further discussions on the bill? And then we do have a member of the public who is here to testify in opposition to the bill. Any further discussions? Senator Foley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I am concerned about the $25 fine. I think that in the traffic code that my recollection was that there are no other fine that's so de minimis that it really isn't telling our youth that we're concerned about that, and that a $25 fine, even in this day with deficits, doesn't amount to anything. So for the same reasons, I would vote to strike those references that apply on the $25 fine in page 1 and lines 121 and 123.
Senator Foley, is that a motion to strike the references to the $25 fines?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Senator Foley moves to strike the following language. Mr. Backus, could you take us through that?
Madam Chair.
Senator Limmer.
Senator Foley, on the $25 fine, the question I have is, if you remove the $25 reference as a fine, what are you replacing it with?
Madam Chair and Senator Limmer.
Senator Foley.
I think the way the traffic code is developed, that it would be in the chapter that provides for a certain level of fines in the entire chapter. So my guess is that if we strike the language that I have in there in my copy right now and insert petty misdemeanor, that would be the appropriate resolution, perhaps. But council probably get a better idea.
Senator Murphy, and then Senator Foley, just for your information, council advises that it's not as simple as just striking the $25 reference. So, Senator Murphy.
Well, Madam Chair, I understand what Senator Foley's doing, I can't say that he's entirely wrong. Most of the time we want to get people's attention in the area of transportation. We increase fines. And we've done that in several areas. If you are now speeding and you're excess of 20 miles an hour over the speed limit, your fine gets doubled. If you're caught going over 100 miles an hour, you're going to lose your license and you're going to get your fine doubled. Part of me agrees with Senator Foley, but what we found out about trying to get this bill passed is that You know, this kind of tugs at the heartstrings of some people, you know, on the civil libertarian side, and to quell some of their argument as to we were going to use this to make money for state, that argument, we decided to have the fine at 25 and then also, you know, reduce those surcharges as well. Overall, I think that the fine schedule that we have in the bill is appropriate. Every year, there's been fewer and fewer unbelted drivers ticketed for not wearing their seatbelt. And I think it has a lot to do with the campaign that the commissioner and his department and, you know, safety groups all across the United States have done to try to raise public awareness. But in this building, we have to, it's nice to have bills and pass them around, but it's better to have a law. And in order for us to get a law, then we had to make some compromises on that.
Senator Foley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I agree with Senator Murphy, and I realize that there's a difference between the put something in there and then not being able to pass the legislation. So I therefore withdraw my motion.
Senator Foley has withdrawn his motion. Senator Olson, do you have any other comments?
Well, Madam Chair, I guess I was just going to say that as much as I support Senator Murphy's bill, I echo the sentiment. And I would also say that, you know, the whenever there's any kind of a traffic ticket issued, there's also the insurance consequence, which I would think would make parents apt to want to make sure that their kids are wearing seatbelts, you know, and that this is more than just about the $25 fine. I think the most important part of this is that we're making it a primary law in terms of its enforceability.
Senator Olson, I believe that on page 2, line 2.3, of the bill, there is some reference to that might alleviate some of your concerns about it being part of the record. If there are no further questions to Senator Murphy on the specifics of the bill, I'm going to ask our public member, Ms. Danette Triandafilio, to please come up and testify. And I apologize for totally not doing a very good job on your name. Welcome to the committee, and please state your name very clearly for the record and for my benefit so that I may be able to pronounce it correctly.
Okay. Madam Chair and members, my name is Danette Triandafilio.
Please proceed with your testimony.
Okay. In my experience, I'm 67. I've been driving since I was 15. In all cases where I had maybe a total of 3 accidents in that time, all of them have been in the form of side swipes. Had I been wearing a seatbelt the first time, the driver's door was pushed in and the inside handle or the armrest hit me in the hip. Had I been belted in, I would have suffered probably internal damages, broken pelvis, who knows what else. However, the impact threw me to the passenger side. The second time it happened, my head went to it was a 2-door car, so there's the column between front and back door. The impact hit my head. However, I was thrown again into the driver's side. I could have suffered extremely bad head injury, been left a vegetable, could have died, and all because I would have been wearing a seatbelt. I was not. Now, the most recent one, I had a passenger. And I was driving a truck. I always drive trucks. And I was making a left-hand turn, and the truck was T-boned between the truck bed and the cab. Had my passenger been belted in, she would have either been killed or at least badly injured. However, the impact pushed her into my body, so for a few days I had a sore rib and a sore shoulder, and that was the extent. So in my experience, I haven't had front end, rear end, or anything like that where I'm speeding. I don't drink. I never have. And for that reason, I don't like wearing a seat belt. I have another friend who is extremely portly, and even with an extension, he can't wear that seat belt. It's cut in short, sort of like the Pillsbury Doughboy. And he cannot wear a seat belt. It cuts him in the neck, and he has a hard time trying to hook it up. And for that reason, I don't wear a seat belt, and I don't think we should be forced to make that a primary offense. If you have any questions, I'm ready for them.
Seeing none, thank you very much for making the time to come to the committee today.
Okay.
Thank you. We have a form right there. If you could please enter your information for the record. Thank you. Any further questions or discussions for Senator Ortman?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question for counsel. The summary that you gave us talks about the change in the seatbelt law, and your summary says it allows primary enforcement of the seatbelt law. Can you just explain a little further what you mean by that, the legal ramifications of that, if you would?
Mr. Backus?
Madam Chair and members, well, currently there's language that's being stricken in law, which is begins on 1.25 and continues to the next page, and it says a peace officer may not issue a citation for a violation of this section unless the officer lawfully stopped or detained the driver of the motor vehicle for a moving violation other than a violation involving motor vehicle equipment. So by striking that, I don't know if this is the only law in Minnesota like this or one of a small handfuls. I haven't reviewed that. But basically, under current law, a peace officer can't pull you over just for that. So this would allow a peace officer to make a stop based on the suspicion that a person is not buckled up.
Senator Ortman.
Madam Chair, perhaps you or the commissioner could clarify what you mean by a suspicion that someone's not wearing a seatbelt. Does the officer then, if we change the law, need to see it and have firsthand knowledge, or can the officer guess? A suspicion. I'm trying to understand under what basis, legal basis now, could an officer stop someone that is less than firsthand knowledge not wearing a seatbelt?
Senator Murphy or Mr. Backus?
Madam Chair and members, I mean, it would be the same standard as pulling a car over for any of a host of other violations. It's considered to be an investigative stop, so you don't have to have the probable cause to arrest a person. I've got some things printed up here I was looking at a little bit earlier. It's permissible based on less than probable cause, requires only a reasonable, articulable suspicion of illegality. These stops, police can have a reasonable suspicion of illegality based on articulable facts, and the officer is not acting with mere capriciousness, arbitrariness, or whimsy.
Madam Chair.
Senator Ortman.
That's pretty hard to distinguish for the officer seeing or not. It sounds to me like anything goes. Whether you see it or not, that someone is wearing a seatbelt. And I'm honestly very concerned about that. Seems like it would justify, the officer says he's not being capricious, stop someone for any reason whatsoever, whether they think they're wearing a seatbelt or not, and withstand that. And I think legally that should give everybody in this committee pause. I understand what's trying to be, you know, what we're trying to accomplish is to keep more people safe in Minnesota and fewer people from dying on the roads. But I also think that an anything goes mentality might allow for some abuse as well. I have another question, hopefully, Madam Chair, for Council. And that would be, once stopped for, I think what you said was a reasonable and articulable suspicion of not wearing a seatbelt, does the officer then have the opportunity to search the vehicle, to look for ID, for immigration status? What else might the officer be able to do once that vehicle and driver are stopped?
Mr. Backus?
Madam Chair, I mean, I'm looking around to see if there's any State Patrol people who want to bail me out a little bit here. But, once you make that stop, I mean, I would think the officer would want to verify whether the person was wearing a seatbelt, maybe ask for identification and driver's license. But, you know, it's going to be based on the facts, how far you go towards something that would be considered more of a seizure, in which case the standard would go up to a probable cause that there's been a violation of law, you know, to make an arrest. In terms of searches, you know, you generally wouldn't be able to do a search, but, you know, if you see something that's in open view or something like that, there are a lot of exceptions to the warrant requirement for searches. So it could very well lead to things like that, but it's just going to depend on the circumstances.
Senator Murphy?
Well, Madam Chairman, I'm going to let Lieutenant Peterson answer that, but it comes right down to this. This is the same thing as anything else that you get pulled over for. Period. And Senator Ortman, I trust law enforcement not to use this as a tool for racial profiling or anything else. And all the studies that have been done in other states show that racial profiling and things like that go down. They don't go up, they go down. And the big thing that happens is that especially people who are overrepresented in the community of color, and I'm talking about young African-American males.
Nice music, Senator Murphy.
I'm sorry. But young African-American men are disproportionately not wearing seatbelts. And once this law was passed in Michigan, they saw a rapid increase in young African-American males wearing seatbelts. That's what we want. That is the activity that we want to happen.
Lieutenant Peterson.
Yes. Madam Chair, Senator Ortman, historically, and we'll just put this in very simple terms, if I'm going to stop someone, it'll be for a moving violation. That means I'm stopping you for speeding, going through a semaphore, not signaling lane changes, a moving violation, and through the course of that investigation, I may see that you weren't wearing your seatbelt before I stopped you, opposite direction. Radar for working, or I'm at a light and I watch you go through that, I could see you're not wearing a seatbelt, and that subsequently would mean you get issued one in conjunction with whatever the moving violation is. As far as going into a vehicle, I have to have a reason, and I have to be able to articulate that reason. Putting seatbelt enforcement aside, that's the way it is, as the Senator talked about, for all of our stops. And we go to great lengths to train our people to do that properly and to follow the law.
Any other discussions in Senate File 42?
Madam Chair.
Senator Limmer and Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Murphy, a few years ago, I remember quite a few members of the minority community in this state came to the legislature regarding probably not seatbelt primary offense issues, but certainly the question of racial profiling and the reason why they were pulled over. On the suspicion that something was going on in the car and it couldn't even be seen. And it occurred in the confines of this committee. And we had a very lively discussion. And you could tell it was a very sensitive issue in the minority community. Have you vetted this bill in the minority community so they're aware that this is going on? And do they have any concerns at this time regarding this particular issue?
Senator Murphy.
Madam Chairman and Senator Limmer, Congressman Ellison is 100% supportive of this endeavor. Chief Harrington of the St. Paul Police Department is 100% supportive of this endeavor. And Ms. Pat Everett Smith is here from Meharry College and has done extensive research on vehicle safety. And if you want her to address the racial profiling issue, I'm sure that she would be more than willing.
Madam Chair.
Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair, and members, several years ago when some iteration of this bill came up, I remember someone coming to my office and telling me, but the Urban League supports this, the African-American organization. And I said, well, that can't possibly be true because everybody's always telling me what a bad bill this is. So I called up the executive director of the Minneapolis Urban League and said, this is what somebody told me. He says, well, that just can't be true. Let me check. And he called back a few minutes later, and he says, imagine my surprise. The National Urban League, mm-hmm. it takes a strong stance for this bill because of the number of young African-American men who are in really bad car accidents and die. And we both thought that was a very good piece of advice, very good piece of information for both of us to have. And so I'm just sharing it with you. So I know that it is a hotly discussed issue in the communities of color, and it has to do with more than just a seatbelt. It has to do with other things as well. Mm-hmm. But on this issue, at least, I know the National Urban League will support it.
Well, you know, members of the committee, I'm glad to hear that there is some interest in racial profiling in this committee. Senator Latz, I believe, will be has already introduced, will be introducing and carrying the racial profiling bill. And so I look forward to having his bill in the committee for a very robust discussion. Because I think that, you know, we've signaled that we have an interest in looking at this issue, and I think that this absolutely is the appropriate committee to be asking those questions, and I think it will be a very good discussion. And I understand people's concerns and hesitancy, and I appreciate that. I think that this bill is very critical and very important. And while we want to create the opportunity to highlight the racial profiling discussion, I do think that we will have a very good opportunity with Senator Latz's bill to do much more work on the racial profiling issue. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Murphy. Just to follow up on Senator Ortman's question, just for my own edification, I guess, so I understand this. Wouldn't it be the situation? I mean, people are going to be stopped because a police officer believes that he sees that someone in the car isn't wearing a seatbelt. I'm assuming that that'll be the practical, you know, ramification of this bill, as opposed to other situations like we have now, where unless that person runs the stoplight or is speeding or something else, you could be sitting next to someone noticing that no one has a seatbelt on and that people, maybe even children, are in danger and not be able to do anything about it. So where is that difference in, I mean, what practical difference does that standard make? I mean, in terms of how it would be applied here, isn't it going to be the case that the police officer will have to be able to articulate that he saw someone he didn't believe was wearing a seatbelt?
Senator Murphy?
Madam Chair, I think we heard Lieutenant Peterson answer that clearly. And you know, it's the judgment of the law enforcement officer. Now, I trust law enforcement. I trust them to make the right call. And if they see somebody in that car that's not wearing a seatbelt and they pull them over and write them a ticket, you know, I say bravo. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't think that there's that many law enforcement officers that are out there that are going to just start pulling people over because they think they might have seen something. Most of the time when law enforcement, or I should say, in my opinion, 99.9999% of the time, when law enforcement pulls somebody over, they have a reason. They were swerving and, you know, they went across the fog line or the center line. They got a tail light that's out. They ran a stop sign. It's something they see. And I don't think that, and I really don't believe that this law is any different. Law enforcement's not going to pull somebody over if they're driving according to the rules of the road, which include having your seatbelt buckled up. This is the only law that we have on the folks that's unenforceable. It's unenforceable. right now, if Lieutenant Peterson leaves the Capitol and he's driving down Highway 61, he's going through Cottage Grove, and he sees a carload full of teenagers abiding by all the laws, driving the speed limit, staying in their lane, you know, not goofing off, and none of them have seatbelts on, he can't do anything about it. And those kids are breaking the law, period. That's what it comes down to me. Let's give police officers the ability to save lives out there instead of having to clean them up off the highway.
Senator Foley, and then members, I think that unless there are some specific questions to the specific of the bill, I think we have to move on it. Senator Latz is waiting for his two bills. Senator Foley.
Madam Chair, one of the things that we neglected to touch on here was the fact that that this bill, I carried it myself for about 10 years, and it's a kind of a situation where we've heard all kinds of testimony indicating supported by the Urban League and a whole host of others. The thing that I think is what people are failing to see is that under existing law, cop can see the violator not having a seatbelt, but she or he cannot stop them for that unless they're committing a speeding or over the center line or something like that.
Madam Chair.
Senator Ortman.
The distinction, however, is why we reached the compromise in the first place, in my view. We reached the compromise that it would be a violation of law, but it would be unenforceable because there's a perception. I trust law enforcement, but there's a perception. This is why so many people are against this bill, perception that it gives unfettered discretion. And the distinction is that with respect to all of the other instances the lieutenant gave for stopping someone has violated the law that has put, through a moving violation, put someone else at risk, not just themselves. By failing to wear a seatbelt, I may put myself at risk, but I haven't created a danger to anybody else, a risk to anybody else, just to myself. And now we've got a whole new world where law enforcement is going to protect us against ourselves. And the perception on the part of many in the public is that that is more government than they need. And so I think we should at least face that reality in this committee, that that's more government than we need. And the law enforcement could be respectful if there's a violation, pull someone over, a moving violation, if it's a risk. But this is not a risk to anybody but the person failing to wear the seatbelt.
Madam
Chair, Senator Murphy.
That is absolutely untrue. There's two risks associated with it, Senator Ortman. A friend of mine happens to be a state patrol officer in state Illinois. He told me about 5 years ago, I've never unbuckled a dead person. Great. I saw him last Thanksgiving. He said, I unbuckled my first dead person. And the reason was is because that was the driver of the car. He was buckled up, and the passenger in the back seat was not buckled up. He flew through the windshield and on the way by clipped the guy in the back of the head with his boot and killed him. So it's not true on that instance. And the other thing that you're doing when you're driving around and you're not buckled up and you end up being a statistic, that costs the state of Minnesota and everybody here $1.1 million for every fatality that happens on our roads. It's not true that this is only affecting you. It's not true.
Senator Schad.
Madam Chair, and I go back to a conversation I had with Senator Frank many years ago, and it's actually what convinced me that seatbelts, you know, probably was our business, that people wear them. And it had to do with a situation where a father was riding with his child, and they weren't wearing seatbelts. They were in a crash, and the father was saved by the body of his child cushioning him from the windshield and the dash. The child, of course, was killed. So maybe, you know, I could even buy your argument. If you're all alone in your car and you're the driver, I still think you pose a risk. But it's also got to do with the people in that car with you. And I understand that now we require those children to be belted and in booster seats if they're old enough, and child restraint seats otherwise. So I think it is a matter of concern to other people and other people's safety. It's not just the driver.
Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair, one comment.
Commissioner Campion.
We did not educate, we did not enforce our way to 87% compliance rate here in the state of Minnesota. We educated our way to that compliance rate. That last 10% is a sticky 10% to try to comply with the law. All data were throughout the country, the 26 states that have passed a primary seatbelt, that is what has focused and changed the mind of that last 8 or 10%. This isn't about enforcement. This is about messaging and an education to get that last group of people to wear a seatbelt. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, about that, however.
Senator Ortman.
We didn't need to enforce this primarily in order to get that huge increase in education and people wearing seatbelts.
Senator Higgins, would you move the bill?
Yes.
Do you care about that or not?
It wasn't what I was going to say, but it
looks well.
Madam Chair, I move that Senate file, whatever it is, 42, be recommended to pass. Does it need to go to another committee, or are we to
finance?
The
to the committee.
Oh, to finance.
Senator Higgins moves that Senate file 42 as amended be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Finance. Any further discussions? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay.
Nay.
No. Motion prevails. Bill passes.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Commissioner and Lieutenant and our State Patrol, thank you for the film. It's wonderful. Thank you.
Wonderful.
Well, it's wonderfully
effective.
Instructional
effective.
And effective. Senator Latz.
Fog line is and where it's defined. Well, I mean, that doesn't make any sense. So I wanted to say, tell me what statute ban or whatever. I think that's
1819. Senator Latz, which one would you like to take first?
Madam Chair, Senate File 94, the 35W Bridge Corrections Bill.
Where are we now? Let's see.
Right. Senator Latz, welcome to the committee on Senate File 94.
Thank you, Madam
Chair. He has
Chair,
two bills up. Members. He has 93 and 94.
You will all recall that we had special legislation last year to provide for a compensation mechanism for the survivors of the collapse of the I-35W bridge. It was a lengthy bill that was put together over many months. It was done in a very unique situation, and some of the language, it turns out, we would like to clean up just a little bit. So this is basically a minor corrections bill that you have in front of you to fix some of the language. Before we go through those particular provisions, I would ask that the committee adopt two amendments that would be proposed as author's amendments. One you have in front of you, the A1 amendment.
The A1 amendment is being passed out right now.
He's
coming. Senator Latz will take the A1 amendment as an author's amendment, and then we'll get Senator Olson to move your other amendment. Senator Latz, move the A1 amendment.
Madam Chair, I'm not on the committee. I guess technically it's not an author's amendment.
I would move that.
Senator Foley moves the A1 amendment as the author's amendment to put the bill in the shape he would like it to be in. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. Let's pass out the A2, the other amendment, too.
Also. Let me see if it's C8. I'm not sure if it's C8-2 amendment. I should turn to Ms. Pontius. Actually, it would be an oral amendment, but it would be to put the bill in the shape in which the author would like to have.
All right. Senator Olson moves the A2 amendment, and Ms. Pontius will read the A2 amendment as follows.
Madam Chair and members, it would be on page 1, delete lines 15 to 19, and then on line 20, delete the C and insert B. So basically, it's deleting paragraph B.
Delete what?
Ms. Pontius, could you please repeat
Madam
the amendment?
Chair, on page 1, delete lines 15 to 19, which is paragraph B, and then just reletter paragraph C on line 20 to paragraph B.
Senator Latz, perhaps you can give us an explanation of that amendment.
Sure, Madam Chair, members, there was some lack of clarity as to what kind of data practices or access there would be to some of the records created by the special commission that was set up to evaluate claims and make awards. This was going to be an attempt to clarify that, but as I have been told, it's sort of a belt and suspenders approach. It's not necessary. The governor's office has raised some questions about the language or the linguistics in paragraph B, and rather than go through the process of trying to find common ground on the specific words, we think it's not necessary to keep it in and read it.
All right. So Senator Olson moves the oral amendment as read by counsel. Any further discussions on that oral amendment? Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Latz, does this mean that any records that are created by a member of the panel are now subject to the Minnesota Official Records Act or the Minnesota Government Practices Act? Are we making an assumption that they are then covered by that or under the authority of those rules or statutes?
Senator Latz.
Madam Chair, Senator Limmer, there was language in the main bill that we passed last year that specified how that should be handled. I don't have that language in front of me, but I'm going to ask Al Gilbert, Solicitor General of the State of Minnesota, to specifically respond to your question.
Members, let's adopt this amendment, and if we disagree with it, we certainly could restore the language. I'd like for Senator Latz to present the bill, and then we can have the discussion. So on Senator Olson's motion to adopt the oral amendment, any further discussions? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Now, Senator Latz, could you give us the context of the bill and then maybe walk us through what the new language is attempting to do, incorporating in the two amendments?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. What I'm going to do is just highlight the main points, and I'm going to ask Solicitor General Gilbert to give you the specific context for it, if that's all right with the Chair.
Please proceed, Senator Latz.
Thank you. Madam Chair, the first section gives some clarification with regard to the discoverability of the records or the of the panel members in any civil administrative proceedings. So the records that each member of the panel creates in the process of evaluating the claims and deciding on the awards would not be discoverable in civil litigation, would not be discoverable in an administrative proceeding unless there's some suspicion that it was related to criminal activity, and then it would be discoverable. In Section 2 of the bill, we're now on page 2, the clarification with regard to indemnification so that the members of the panel basically can't be sued, or if they are sued anyway, the state will cover their liability if the suit were successful. That's not uncommon for members of commissions and stuff like that, but we needed to clarify that for the panel members as well. Section 3 is a privilege provision which addresses not the records created by panel members, but the panel members' testimony itself in any civil administrative proceedings. And the Section 4 clarifies language with regard to third-party subrogation. There's a provision in the main bill that relates to a waiver of subrogation rights because of the way that the compensation scheme was set up. It's come to the attention of the conclusion of the panel members and the Attorney General's office that it would be beneficial to clarify the language there so there isn't any ambiguity about what the original intent of the legislation was.
Very good.
And I'd ask Solicitor General Gilbert to fill in any blanks that I didn't fill in or answer your more specific questions.
Mr. Gilbert, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you. My name is Alan Gilbert. I'm the State Solicitor General. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I really don't have anything to add to what Senator Latz has said. I probably could provide a little bit of background as to the first three changes that were proposed. You might recall that the special panel members were appointed by the Chief Justice of the Minnesota Supreme Court. And as a result, there's a little bit of ambiguity as to whether they're subject to provisions dealing with court process or whether they're subject to provisions dealing with this legislative process. And you'll see in Section 1 of the bill, Subdivision 3, in the original enactment of the bill, there was reference to the data practices status of some of the information. This created somewhat of an ambiguity because typically the court records are not subject to the State Data Practices Act, but there is some reference to it here in this legislative proposal. At the same time, the members of the special master panel are appointed by the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. So there was some concern expressed by the panel members and by the Supreme Court, you know, as to what the status was of these panel members as it related to application of the Government Official Records Act and the Data Practices Act. And the provision that has been deleted by amendment today tried to deal with that. And it really was a belt and suspenders type amendment for a number of very technical reasons. And to the extent there had been some concerns raised by some, including the governor's office, in talking with Senator Latz, we thought it was just best to take it out, so there is no controversy regarding that. As to the other provisions, I think as Senator Latz said, in terms of discoverability, testimonial privilege, things of that kind, it's rather common in situations like this, and it's analogous to the mediator's privilege under the alternative dispute resolution privilege under Chapter 595 to provide for these kinds of protections. In terms of indemnification, you can see in the existing bill that the panel members are actually immune from liability. But they wanted to make sure that if someone nonetheless sued them, that they would be entitled to some sort of defense from the Attorney General's office. And that's what this language accomplishes as it regards indemnification. And then on the subrogation waiver language, there was some concern raised through the process as to whether the waiver that was intended by the legislature applies just to payments from the fund or the fund itself, or whether it also applies to any claim of subrogation that might be made against the state, its employees, state municipalities, or their employees. And I think it's clear that the intent of the legislature, based upon other provisions of the bill, was that that waiver apply across the board to the state as well and its municipalities and employees. And that's what this amendment accomplishes by clarification. So with that, if you have any questions, I'd be happy to address them.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If this is passed into law, would we be permanently sealing these records from any type of public scrutiny in the future by the passing of this as law?
Senator Latz or Mr. Gilbert?
I'll defer to Mr. Gilbert.
Okay. Madam Chair, Senator Limmer, that's a very complicated question in terms of what the status is of those documents. As I indicated under Section 1, Subdivision 3, it's very clear what documents are public under the law. When it comes to notes and things of that kind of special panel members, to the extent it reflects their mental processes, it probably would not be public under the law. And the notes may not be retained as well. But in terms of other provisions dealing with the records of expenses and salary and things of that kind, those would be public by express provision of the statute.
But, Madam Chair, the discussion regarding what the panel does, what their work is, and how it relates to individual citizens that are under the, or let's call them survivors in this case for using the same terms, that would be permanently sealed. And yet, the more the workings of the panel, the payment, the per diem, and all of that would be open to public review. But the meat and potatoes of what's going on and what they do will be permanently sealed, and no one will have access to those records? Is that the question? And is that, do I understand your answer correctly?
Mr. Gilbert.
Madam Chair, Senator Limmer, no, I don't think you do, and I'm sorry I wasn't clear enough. The what is probably going to be protected under the Data Practices Act, as I said, is their mental processes. Why they gave a particular person a certain award. That implicates their medical situation, their medical records, things of that kind. Their general processes, how they implemented the statute generally, that would be public. As I understand it, there's an intention and a request from Senator Latz and Representative Winkler in the House that the panel, at least one of the panel members, make a presentation to the legislature as to how they process claims generally. But as it relates to individual claims, they wouldn't be in a position to say, I gave this person this much money because of this particular injury or this particular situation.
Madam Chair,
Senator Limmer.
Would an individual survivor be able to have access to the records involving their particular claim, or would they be prevented from that also?
Mr. Gilbert.
Madam Chair, Senator Limmer, I believe they'd probably be precluded as well. They will get a final decision from the panel saying this is what we think your damages are under the particular legislation we're talking about, and then there'll be an indication of how much of the pro rata amount of money that's available that they'll receive as a result, and that's what they'll receive. I want to say that also in response to your question that there is going to be other litigation brought by many of the survivors because they are limited in what they can get from the state and they might have claims against other entities. I think there's a balance that's trying to be struck here so that whatever reasoning as to an individual survivor that a panel member engages in doesn't inure to their detriment in terms of the litigation they might bring against others. Because the first person who might want to see that and see if it helps them might be an alternative tortfeasor under the law. So there's some balance that's struck by these provisions.
Madam Chair, the reason
Senator Limmer.
I raise this question is there's always the question whenever we start dealing with data that we we're writing it as a confidential status of information in the state records. There's always the question whenever we deal with this type of information of who owns the information, who is the owner, and who can restrict the public from reviewing it. And despite the fact that there's survivors and that there may be discussion about individual survivor claims, we're making a statement in this bill that the survivor is not the owner or has any type of sense of ownership to use this information for their own purpose. So that raises just the general question of data privacy and who owns the data. The other question that I'd like to refer to is on page 2, lines 5 and 6, when it makes these particular indemnification specific to the members of this panel. And yet there will come a time, because we don't cover it in Minnesota state law, there's other panels in state, local, county governing, when we create citizen task forces and other entities that help us do our job in focusing on information, we go out and form a committee of sorts to give us information on anything. And sometimes there's lots of data that goes back and forth from citizen to the advisory board, from the advisory board to the elected official. And where do we put the protection of that information, or what's open to the public and what's not? We haven't even tiptoed into that area in state law. But this panel is rather unique, and now we're restricting and indemnifying it, which might go in a different direction than I may want to go on other panels. So at least for the very least purpose, I would say notwithstanding any other advisory board panel, et cetera, that any state government or political subdivision involves itself, this panel will be handled this way. And I would suggest that might be an addition as an amendment, at least to put some comfort level into this
language,
so we don't create any other type of pattern of treatment of information.
Yes. Madam Chair.
Senator Olson, on this point?
Yes.
Senator Olson?
Madam Chair, and just kind of following up on that point, these are public funds. And I'm trying to think if there's another example of a situation where, you know, if a court makes a decision, even if there's a lot of other litigation involved, the judge has to write an opinion or an arbitrator has to write an opinion and explain their decision when it comes to this type of an allocation. And I can think of a case I was involved with years ago where, you know, we had public funds involved and we used to enter into settlement agreements that would where there would be confidentiality clauses that both parties might have wanted. But I remember the AG's office, I think it was at that time, wrote an opinion saying that you can't do that because that's public money. And so if the public wants to know the terms of that settlement agreement, they have a right to know that. So, you know, I'm inclined to think that this is an unusual circumstance and more inclined to maybe consider it when it's in the benefit of victims as opposed to, you know, some other reason. But I still am real concerned about the precedent it sets, and I tend to agree with Senator Limmer about those observations.
Senator Lassen, Mr. Gilbert, when under the framework, the contemplation for that framework is that the work of the special master's panel would be under the auspice of the judicial branch, right? And so that's why we've come back to try to clarify, because the original intent is that it would be judicial branch action and not necessarily, not explicitly, not legislative or other government action subject to the data privacy laws, but under the judicial branch.
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, that's definitely correct. And this is an unusual situation. I say it's almost, it is unique in many respects. And that's why this provision is written the way it is. We certainly understand the concerns that you and Senator Limmer have expressed.
Any further discussion?
Because of the unusual judicial nature of it, this seems to be consistent with how the judiciary handles these kinds of things.
Any further discussions on Senate File 94? As amended. Seeing none, Senator Foley moves that Senate File 94 as amended be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee of the Whole. Any further discussion? Seeing none, all those to the yes.
Yeah, that one goes to
the yes. The Committee of the Whole, I believe, is a Senate floor. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay.
Nay.
Motion prevails. The bill passes. Senate File 93, Senator Latz.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Senate File 93 arises out of my experience in dealing with the 35W bridge collapse claims process. Under current state tort law, generally applicable, the state liability is capped in two ways. There is an overall cap on the amount of money that the state would have to pay out for any one incident or occurrence, and there is an individual cap that applies to the amount of money an individual person who was injured would be able to recover from the state. The same law applies to subdivisions of the state. It's a different provision in the statute, but the same scheme is set up. When we had about 180 some persons that were on the bridge when it collapsed, most of whom were injured to a small or very severe degree, and 13 people who died, the existing state liability aggregate or per occurrence cap in effect at the time the bridge collapsed was $1 million. $1 million to cover all of the liability, compensate for all of the injuries that were arguably caused by the state, for all 180-some people. That would have been nowhere near enough to adequately compensate people for their loss, not even for their vehicles in most cases, let alone personal injuries. They were also subject to the individual liability cap of $300,000 per person. We made two changes in the overall bridge compensation bill that was passed. The one main change, about which there was almost immediate consensus across the board among all of the legislators that were dealing with this issue, was that that $1 million aggregate cap applied to the bridge situation would have been wholly unfair. And wholly unfair. It would have compressed the ability of individuals to recover to mere pennies on the dollar. The second and more difficult issue that persisted throughout the process was what to do with the individual liability cap. So what in the end we did is we declared for purposes of the bridge compensation process that the aggregate or per occurrence cap of $1 million would not apply to the particular incident that we were dealing with, the collapse of the 35W bridge. We separately applied a change in the individual liability cap, raised it from $300,000 to $400,000, which was the amount of the individual cap that was took effect January 1st following the bridge collapse. So there was a logical reference point there. It seemed to me, and others that I have spoken with about this, that if it was unfair to cap the state's liability at $1 million, or right now the law in effect is $1.2 million, I believe, for an event in which there are many injured persons. If it was unfair to do that for the bridge collapse, it would also be unfair to do that if there were an accident involving a state-run bus or a state van, which actually happened in the mid-90s, or any other event in which a person is injured and they happen to be injured in an event that had more people than just them and two others injured. Two others, because under the current law, $400,000 individual cap times three people is $1.2 million. So under existing law, you could only fully compensate up to the individual cap three people in any one incident. If you had four people in an auto accident that the state was to blame for, they would not be eligible for full compensation. So this bill remedies that inequity. This bill would delete or remove the aggregate cap as it applies to state liability as a permanent change in the state tort claims law. That's basically the point. I do have a witness with me who would I'd like to ask the committee to listen to. Her name is Linda Paul. She is a survivor of the 35W bridge compensation collapse.
Very good. Ms. Paul? Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
I will. My name is Linda Paul, and I am a survivor of the 35W bridge collapse. Hopefully, the legislature and the citizens of Minnesota will never again have to endure a catastrophe of that magnitude. There will always be claims against the state, and undoubtedly some of them will involve multiple victims. One thing this legislature can do to make the process less stressful for future claimants is to eliminate the aggregate cap on claims. Prior to August 1st, 2007, I had never been in a major automobile accident, and I had no idea what impact it would have upon my life. The severity of my injuries were such that it took 3 months before I was able to return to even a light-duty position with my now former employer, Hirschfields. During that time, I was totally dependent upon my husband and family members to help me deal with the day-to-day tasks that most of us take for granted. Added to that were numerous visits to multiple doctors, phone calls from insurance adjusters, visits by investigators, paperwork to be filled out, and a constant stream of questions to be answered. And I can't imagine how victims who didn't have family and friends to turn to were able to cope with their situations. Shortly after the bridge collapse, I became aware that caps existed in Minnesota statute limiting the liability of the state. This surprised me, as I'm sure it surprised many Minnesotans. I am grateful that Representative Ryan Winkler and Senator Ron Latz took the initiative to address those inequities so that the 172 collapsed victims would not have to share the $1 million cap, which would have been approximately $5,800 per person. One of the few reassurances that my husband and I have is the knowledge that we will soon receive compensation from the State Bridge Collapse Fund. Over the last year and a half, we have drained our retirement savings, and in addition, our monthly expenses now include almost $1,000 for health insurance through COBRA. That became necessary after my light-duty position at Hirschfields was eliminated when I was unable to return to my job as a designer. It terrifies me to be unemployed in an economy that is daily looking more and more like the Great Depression. Last year, the caps caused sometimes bitter division amongst the bridge survivors. This placed an unnecessary burden upon a group that should have been united in their efforts. There was a faction that believed that there should be no caps, individual or aggregate. For the most part, this was due to their belief that the state was their only recourse for compensation and that lawsuits against other parties were not possible. Furthermore, they believed that the bridge collapse was not analogous to the Drew Shedin tragedy and saw no problem with unlimited awards to victims of the bridge collapse when the Shedin family had gotten $300,000. Future victims of malfeasance by the state should not have to fight over a limited aggregate cap. Last year, the legislature understood the logic of eliminating the cap for victims of the 35W bridge collapse, and that same logic should justify the elimination of the cap once and for all. And thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee.
Thank you, Ms. Paul.
You're welcome.
Madam Chair, Ms. Paul was one of the most severely injured persons on the bridge, and as she sits before you here today, it may not appear that way. She's made a tremendous recovery in many respects, she would have been severely restricted in recovering for her own damages had the aggregate cap applied, even as the individual cap has had impact there. And our legislation made some unique exceptions to that. She's a testament to fortitude even to be here today.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Thank
you're
you
welcome.
For coming to the committee. Senator Latz, that raises a question for me, actually. In the bill, even though you lift the cap, there is some language reference to it is still subject somewhat to a cap because it does reference available appropriations from the legislature. Could you speak to that a little bit?
Yes, Madam Chair. I actually had some discussions prior to the committee hearing with counsel, Ms. Pontius, and with the Attorney General's office, and trying to determine what exactly to do with that. It would be my desire, actually, to eliminate that language from the bill. Whatever we do is subject to appropriations. Whatever liabilities the state has is subject, of course, to there being the money to pay it. I think ultimately that if a judge were to order the state to pay a judgment, the state would probably have to appropriate the money to pay that judgment or find the funds from somewhere. And I think the language in here in the bill dealing with subject to available appropriations needlessly confuses that issue. So I would ask if a member of the committee would be willing to offer an amendment to delete the language in the bill that deals with that piece.
Any discussions?
Madam Chair.
Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, did you refer to specific language?
Apologize. Members,
29.
On page 2, line 9, Actually, Section C speaks about even though we are, in essence, in Senator Latz's proposed language, lifting the aggregate cap, Section C on page 2 does talk about the fact that there would be limits, and it says, or the available appropriations under paragraph B, implying that even though there's no cap, I guess in the deliberation process, you know, the jury wouldn't be told about whether there's cap or not, so a judgment will come down. But ultimately, if, let's say, the amount in the judgment comes down and it exceeds whatever amount MnDOT has set aside, it would ultimately come to us to appropriate the amount to be appropriate for that judgment. And I think that it created a little bit of inconsistency. Senator Latz wants to eliminate that, so it does throw the door wide open so that if there is a judgment now, we would, in essence... The issue here is that I'm not sure if by limiting that language we necessarily deal with the gray area, because if the department, let's say MnDOT or an agency or a certain department doesn't have the money, ultimately they're going to come to the legislature to appropriate that money, and we still have to make the decision on whether or not we will appropriate the money to meet the judgment. I think that this is a really important point for discussion, and they go hand in hand. I think that historically the reason why decisions were made to impose a cap was so that we could kind of clearly define or put a finite, you know, ceiling on what we think the state liability ought to be, arbitrary as it is, but that to make that finite. And this bill is significant in that we are departing from that. But regardless of whether the language is in here or not, I think that at some point we have to make that decision. So,
Madam Chair.
Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, then, and I was looking at the language of parents B, also lines 1 through 4, the new language, and that refers to availability of appropriations as well. And I didn't know if you were discussing taking it out of there and in C, or and I'm not sure we should, because at the end of the day, this is still subject to the availability of the state of this, or the state's willingness or ability to make those appropriations, right?
That's correct.
Chair.
Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, if we took this language out, does this give us a little bit of latitude? So, for example, if there were an award that, even though we might need to appropriate the money in order to pay the award, we might be bound to make that appropriation and not have any discretion. If this language isn't in there, I'm just thinking, like, couldn't we be taken to federal court if we didn't honor an agreement and be forced to appropriate the money?
Senator Latz, Ms. Pontius?
Madam Chair, I can give you my thumbnail on that based upon my conversations with folks. First of all, Senator Scheid was right in terms of where the language, you'd have to take line 2.3 put a period after 2009, delete the rest of 2.3, delete 2.4, and delete 2.5 through 11, and then change the D on line 12 to a C. I think the answer is to Senator Olson's question is yes, from my understanding, that if there's a if the state is found liable and damages are awarded in the court of law, then the state has an obligation to pay those damages. But what this does not do is create an unlimited liability. The liability for the state would then simply be the individual cap times the number of people involved in the incident. So this would not change the individual cap. If there were 10 people involved in an incident and they were subject to a $400,000 individual cap, then you still have a cap of $4 million on the state's liability.
Any further discussions on that point?
What you, if I might add, Madam Chair, what you end up, what you end up with, if you don't do it by deleting the subject to available appropriations provision, you would end up with basically the legislature making moral or other judgments on each individual tort case that gets settled or that there is a judicial judgment about. And we would see a regular, I shouldn't say regular, you don't know how many large incidents like this there would be. But you would see a stream of some degree of cases coming through the legislative process and arguments in this committee or whichever committees would happen to have to hear it over, well, is it worth going above the $3 million in this case? Are we really going to appropriate $5 million and not $3 million because the injuries to this person is more deserving than the injuries were to the last case that we heard? And I don't think we want the legislature to be substituting its judgment for that of the jury or a judge in that kind of a situation, or if it's a settlement for that of the Attorney General's office in reaching those settlements or the Department of Administration is involved in making those kind of settlements. It would be awfully messy and probably unfair to the victims of those particular cases as well to drag that through the legislative process. So if it were just left, if you delete the subject to available appropriations language, then the normal judicial and settlement process will work its way, and there will still be the cap of the individual cap times the number of people involved.
Senator Lummer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Question for counsel. Do we have a recollection of when the cap was established? What year that may have been?
Yeah, Madam Chair, Senator Lummer, there's a memo, I think, in your materials there that has the legislative history of the caps starting in 76 when they were first enacted.
Madam Chair, I could probably arrive at a conclusion that the cap itself has to be adjusted just due to the 30-plus years that have gone by. To lift the cap entirely, not sure if I would want to go that far, simply because it is not in our, I don't think it would be our desire to lift it to an unlimited figure, kind of a blank check type of reasoning. Senator Latz, had you thought of maybe just adjusting the cap limit rather than just lifting it altogether?
Senator Latz.
Madam Chair, Senator Lummer, first of all, the cap has been lifted or has been adjusted over the years. And in fact, what you see on the first page of the bill is the schedule for the increase that was passed a number of years ago, a couple of years ago. And so between the time when the bridge collapsed and when the legislature considered dealing with that, the cap underwent an already scheduled increase from $1 million to $1.2 million. And it's scheduled this coming July 1st of 2009 to go up to $1.5 million in the aggregate cap. And the individual caps have increased as well. So from that standpoint, I think there's been some changes made. There is no schedule set for beyond that, so at some point the legislature would have to readdress those issues down the road. But with regard to picking a number that would be an appropriate cap, that's the difficulty that I'm actually trying to avoid. The difficulty, any number that you pick is going to be arbitrary because you don't know how many people might be injured in any future event. So if you picked a $3 million cap, but you end up with 50 people injured in some future event, that is going to artificially suppress the amount of money available to the individuals down to lower than their individual caps. And so you just can't predict the future like that. So that arbitrariness is part of what I'm trying to get rid of in the statute. Historically, the reason for having the aggregate cap was to provide some fiscal predictability and some limitation on the exposure of the state's taxpayers to large tort judgments. The most important piece of that, I think, is the ability to make some fiscal predictions about what the obligations of the state might be. When you're dealing with the political subdivisions of the state that typically have much smaller budgets than the state, a large single tort judgment could completely throw their budget out of whack. Could be half their budget, depending, or more, depending on the size of the municipality or the county or whatever it is. The state has a much, much larger fiscal capacity and ability to weather individual fiscal occurrences than any local government would have. So with a $34 billion biennial budget, in the big picture, we can weather a unique tort judgment far better than any local governments could. So it seemed to me that if this, and the only time you get to that point is when there has been a conclusion either by a judge or a jury or a settlement that the state has caused these injuries. That's the nature of these kind of claims. So the state would be legally responsible for having caused the injuries. Then the question is, should the state pay what for the damages that they caused? Placing an artificial aggregate cap on a whole incident seems to me to be work of a terrible unfairness on the individuals that were injured in that particular incident.
Senator
without
Olson.
The justification that has historically been there because of the fiscal capacity issues.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senator Lutz. And I'm just wondering, and I intend to support your bill, but I'm just wondering, I actually think, you know, that states are in a better position than individuals are to pay for individual, to pay an individual for that person's losses, and yet we artificially limit their liability responsibility in that respect. And that's harder for me to understand than this aggregate cap, honestly. But putting that aside, since that's not your bill, do you know if there have been any situations, disasters in other states? And I guess I'm thinking about something like, you know, a mining accident or poisoning of a water supply or in a food supply or something where the potential would be there without this kind of a cap to actually, like, bankrupt the state if we had 1,000 or 10,000 victims or something like that. I mean, is that something you thought about? Is there, you think that's so far-fetched that there's no reason to be concerned about it? Or is that, are there any incidents like that out there that are within the realm of possibility we should be concerned about?
Senator Latz.
Madam Chair, I don't know of any specific cases like that. I can imagine, you know, states that have had experiences with, you know, mining disasters or whatever, and I suppose you can make an argument they didn't properly regulate. And I'm not sure exactly how that would fit into a tort claim scheme. Maybe Ms. Pontius can help clarify on that point. But I think it's a fair question to ask. I don't have a specific answer for you on that question. But if there were such a disaster, I suppose you could argue that the state would want to deal with something the same way that we handled the 35W bridge collapse, dealing with it on a special basis. But I think it's a fair question. I don't know for sure if that would even fall within traditional tort scheme kind of claims or not.
Ms. Pontius.
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, I think at least in terms of the current Minnesota law, it's pretty similar to what most states have. You know, the caps vary, but I think almost all states have sort of the individual claim cap and then a per occurrence cap. I think, you know, maybe 8 to 10 states have special provisions in them under which, even though there are caps, there's kind of a process where individuals can go to the legislature to request more money if in their particular case the cap applies and their damages were greater than that or the judgment's greater than that. And there have been cases in, like I think it was in California after the earthquake, where they did actually create kind of a special compensation process, similar to what was done with the 35W bridge collapse, where the states have kind of responded on sort of a case-by-case emergency basis to those kinds of catastrophes where there's a potential for, you know, government tort liability, and they've just developed sort of an alternative scheme to address it.
Senator Latz, there's been some concerns raised that by lifting the aggregate cap for the state, there will be implications for local government. Mr. Grunhofer is here, and let's hear from him, and then I'd like to dispense with that issue before we take the vote on the bill. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Tom Grunhofer, General Counsel with the League of Minnesota Cities. With due respect to Senator Latz, the League and other local government associations must oppose this bill. We're certainly not unsympathetic to the situation of Ms. Paul and others, but we really, frankly, believe the way it was handled last year in a very rare, you know, an unusual mass tort situation is probably the preferable way to handle these kind of situations. Our opposition to the bill really rests on the equal protection concerns we have and the concern that it might have on municipal budgets. 25 years ago, there was a Supreme Court case entitled Glassman versus State v. Glassman, which basically where the Supreme Court said that they see no rational distinction between the state and local governments for purposes of applying municipal and state tort law. They basically said any kind of disparity between the state and municipal governance would be seen as an equal protection violation. Now, in the years since that Glassman decision 25 years ago, the legislature really has been extremely careful to make sure that the state tort laws mirror and parallel those from local governments because of those equal protection concerns. So while this bill doesn't directly address municipal tort caps, we think because of that Glassman decision and the possible impact of that Glassman decision on actions brought against municipal governments, we really think municipal budgets and municipal tort caps really become vulnerable as a result of this. Senator Latz correctly points out, you know, the fiscal distinction between the state and local governments. And my hope, and it's simply that, would be that a court might understand and appreciate that distinction. In fact, there was a Supreme Court case in Nebraska that upheld that theory. But frankly, I'm not willing to bet that our Minnesota Supreme Court would necessarily decide to follow Nebraska law on that particular question. Tort caps, both state and local, have been upheld through the years in order to protect fiscal integrity. Frankly, right now, as Senator Latz mentioned, municipal budgets would be in grave risk if they had the potential exposure of unlimited tort limits. Frankly, most of our schools, cities, townships, and counties, I don't think the taxpayers in any of those smaller jurisdictions could afford to pay, frankly, the tort judgment to satisfy any kind of untapped or uncapped judgment that might be awarded. So for those reasons, we really do have to oppose the bill, and because of the concerns on local governments. And as has been noted, just 3 years ago, we spent an awful lot of time negotiating the increases in the municipal tort caps and the state tort caps. That law went into effect in 2006. It's transitioning yet another adjustment, as was mentioned, on July 1 of this year. We really think that we ought to let that law work and see how it is handled. With that, I'd be willing to stand for questions.
Any questions for Mr. Grunhofer? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And, sir, I just wonder, since these are things you carry insurance for, have you had any, been given any estimate as to the increase in a premium you might experience if this law went into effect?
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, currently our local governments do write their basic level of coverage basically to follow the existing aggregate cap, so it's at 1.5 or 1.2, depending on where we're at. We do sell excess coverage above that, and I can certainly get you those amounts to show you what that will cost, but I can guarantee you it certainly would increase municipal premium costs significantly. But I will get the full committee that those numbers if you'd like.
Follow-up, Senator Olson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I would appreciate that because you made a statement on the record that the taxpayers are going to have to pay for this, and that's a little misleading, I think, because since this is covered by insurance, what the taxpayers would have to cover is or pay for is the additional cost of a rare occurrence, you know, that granted could be potentially quite large. That's why I was wondering how that would be risk adjusted or evaluated in terms of a premium amount, because I think that would be more kind of honest and, well, not dishonest. I don't mean to imply dishonest, but more helpful information for people to have.
It's the increased cost in the premium.
Right.
I think, Chair, Mr. Grunhofer.
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, I do want to highlight in particular nuance. Every one of the local government groups that I mentioned, counties, schools, townships, cities, they don't really buy insurance. All of those basically get their coverage through a self-insurance pool that those those entities run. So every dollar that you're talking about is taxpayer dollar. It's not somehow money that is coming out of some private corporation. It just doesn't. That's not how we handle insurance for local governments here in Minnesota.
Madam Chair.
Senator Olson.
Well, that's really how all insurance works, is it, you know, aggregates risk. I understand that you do that, but I guess I'm saying one individual county or school district wouldn't pay for this. It would be the cost of the additional premium you would be paying to that self-insured group you're a part of.
Madam Chair, Senator Olson.
Mr. Grunhofer.
I asked the question, and maybe rhetorically, what amount of insurance would a local government buy? Since the exposure is frankly unlimited, and I don't know where you put the... I mean, and certainly every taxpayer would have to pay the judgment above and beyond whatever level is procured.
Madam Chair.
Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, if I might, I think I recall when Senator Latz talked to me about, you know, signing on the bill, that you commented that it wasn't your intention to deal with the municipal or local apps. Am I correct, including the aggregate? Is that right?
Senator Latz.
Madam Chair, Senator Scheid, that is correct.
So, Madam Chair.
Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, and so with that in mind, I mean, I was willing to go on the bill. As I'm looking at the history that Ms. Pontius gave to us, I'm seeing that the court quite often talks about the fiscal stability of the governmental unit involved in these and has upheld the cap, and that seems to be a large part of the reason. I don't see the Glassman case, and I understand that it undoubtedly, you know, what you're saying is true, but it seems that the legitimate government, legitimate government objective of ensuring fiscal stability to carry out the responsibilities of government seems to be also a theme in these court decisions. And obviously, I think we had something roughly like $40 million in the aggregate that we, the state, spent with the I-35W bridge. Is that right, Madam Chair?
Madam Chair, $38 million is the final appropriation.
Okay. So, Madam Chair, I think that I can imagine that could happen to the city of Duluth or, you know, or obviously the Twin Cities or, you know, a bridge someplace or some large structure that causes lots of damage or harms a lot of people. And so, I mean, clearly that would bankrupt a local municipality. And I don't think you could go in the private sector and buy that kind of a policy that had an absolute unlimited cap. I mean, this is relying on taxpayer dollars. And as we did, the $38 million is from Minnesota taxpayers in the Bridge Survivors agreement and settlement with the state. I'm just really concerned about what this might do. If the court would say what's good for the state is good for the local government, I can't even imagine that that would happen. But on the other hand, if that precedent that Mr. Grundhofer is talking about, you know, the equal protection argument were to apply, then it could be pretty difficult for local governments, and that concerns me. So I'd like to Senator Latz, I guess, to respond.
I have a little...
Senator Latz.
Madam Chair, I understand the legal argument, I guess I have a disagreement with Mr. Grundhofer about the risks that are involved here, and I understand local governments would be particularly risk-averse under the circumstances. I know Ms. Pontius has done some research on this question specifically because we've had conversations about this issue, and I don't know if she can further enlighten us with regard to her analysis on this. But from a constitutional standpoint, it's not a heightened level of scrutiny. It would be a rational basis level of scrutiny on an equal protection claim. And basically, if the state can articulate a legitimate policy reason for drawing the distinctions between state government and all of the local units of government, that itself should survive constitutional scrutiny. And that was the basis for the Nebraska Supreme Court's decision. There was a legitimate policy purpose that was articulated by the state. They concluded it was a valid, not just made up out of whole cloth or anything. The state, we've got a $34 billion biennial budget. I think the next largest unit of government would be Hennepin County, and it's in the $1 billion range, I believe. It might be more than that. I'm not sure what the actual numbers are.
$1.6 billion.
For which?
Hennepin County.
Hennepin County is $1.6 billion. Okay, annually. So, I mean, that's, pardon me?
Annually,
okay, 3 points. So it's 10%. Approximately of the state's budget. I think we can legitimately draw a line between the state and the local units of government. The other thing is the state has the constitutionally has the fiscal ability to raise revenues that local governments don't have. The local governments have the authority only as granted by the state and frankly as capped by the state to raise revenues. So a judgment against a local government could be even more difficult to deal with, even though there's a statute that provides them and requires them, in fact, to exercise some levy authority. But the state has much more fiscal flexibility in the long run to deal with large awards, if it were ever to come to that, than local governments have.
Senator Hagan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm looking at the legislative history memo that Ms. Pontius wrote. The last sentence on the first page says that note that the same limitations apply to tort claims against municipalities under Minnesota Statute Section 466.04. And I guess my question is that a reference to this section, or did we just mirror the language in this section in 466.04, or how did we connect the municipalities to this language?
Ms. Pontius.
Madam Chair, Senator Higgins, yeah, the Municipal Tort Claims Act is kind of a parallel provision. So it's in Chapter 466. So it's got the similar language with the same dates and the same dollar amounts in it right now.
So, Madam Chair, Ms. Pontius, with Senator Latz proposing to just change this chapter and or this section and not 466. What I'm trying to understand is that it sounds to me like Senator Latz then says he's deliberately not changing the municipality section, he's just changing the state section. But then Mr. Grundhofer says it doesn't matter because previous courts have ruled that what's here also affects municipalities?
Ms. Pontius.
I'm struggling here. Yeah. I mean, as the non-lawyer, yes. I am so struggling here.
Madam Chair, Senator Higgins, there's one case, basically, that I think is the one that's problematic. It's the Glassman case, which was decided in 94 or 84. Yeah. And now that case dealt with a notice, kind of a procedural provision that was in the Municipal Act, but not in the State Act. And my reading of the case is that it really is limited to that distinction, and it doesn't stand for the proposition that any difference between the state and municipal acts is going to violate the Equal Protection Clause. I think the courts
say that
are,
one again, please.
I think the case really just applied to this one little notice provision that was in the law. There was a notice of claim provision that was in the Municipal Tort Claim Act that wasn't in the State Act. And the court at the time said, well, that was an equal protection problem because there was no rational basis for having individuals who were suing municipalities having to give this special notice when the state law didn't require it. I think after that time, the state law was amended to require it, to bring it into conformity. And now, there was language in the opinion, I know, which is probably what's troubling Mr. Gundhofer and others, that, you know, it talks about just the no rational basis for distinguishing between municipal and state tortfeasors. I read that, though, as being limited just to that notice of claim provision. So courts are going to look at a distinction on a case-by-case basis and say, is there a rational basis for having a different rule apply to the state versus a local government? And if there is a rational basis, you know, a legitimate purpose, and that's furthered by the distinction, then it will be constitutional. And in that Glassman case, they couldn't find that there was any rational basis for having a different notice provision in the two statutes. Now, I think as Senator Latz has mentioned, the argument for a rational basis with respect to the caps being different is that the state has a deeper pocket, and it can absorb the cost of a judgment much more easily than a local government could. And that's why he's proposing to just remove the cap for the state, just the single occurrence cap, but not for municipalities.
Madam Chair.
Senator Higgins.
One more question. Would we be, if what we want to do is what Senator Latz says, is just to deal with the state issues and to keep the municipalities out of it, would we not be well served by putting a sentence in here someplace saying this does not apply to the municipalities, or this specifically exempts the municipalities, or some, I don't know, I suppose you call it comfort language, but if somebody 50 years from now has to figure out what exactly we were trying to do here, we might be well served just to tell them.
Ms. Pontius?
Madam Chair, there actually are, Senator Higgins, there are two statutory schemes, and this one very clearly is just a state law. So it's in a whole different chapter of law. It defines what the state means, and then Chapter 466, which is the Municipal Act, very clearly, I think, applies just to municipalities by their terms. I think that the problem really will come down to the, you know, is in the constitutional question of the difference. But I don't think there's a question that this amendment in itself statutorily is going to remove the cap. It's the question of whether someone's going to challenge it on a constitutional basis.
Mr. Grunhofer?
Madam Chair, I don't mean to speak for counties, but I will for a second. The line or demarcation between what's considered a state activity and what's considered a local government activity, getting to the question that Senator Higgins raises, is not always particularly clear. There's at least two or three places in the statute, for instance, where this municipal cap, at least for certain county activities, is actually waived because they're considered, in essence, agents of the state for certain things they do. I think we do have some potential ambiguity, at least on some of that kind of dual activity sort of stuff, where I think if you go down that road, I think it behooves the group probably to work on some of that stuff.
Mr. Grunhofer, under current law, if a local government, whether that's the county or the city, goes to purchase or get their premium evaluated, the individual who evaluates what that premium would be for each of the local governments would go to Chapter 466 to look at what their single occurrence and what the individual caps are as applicable to local government, correct?
Madam Chair, by and large, that's correct, with the maybe the exceptions that I mentioned for the county situations.
So if Senator Latt's bill passes and we actually change it for the state, again, would there be a reason for why somebody would look at now the local governments differently if all they do is go to Chapter 466?
Madam Chair, with all due respect to the optimism that Ms. Pontius showed on what she thought the, you know, the Supreme Court might determine in the court case that invariably will happen 5 years from now challenging on equal protection grounds, yes, there'll probably be some factoring in to the underwriting process, the prospect that that aggregate cap may be invalidated. I can't exactly put a price tag on how much that will be factored in, but yes, there's certainly a heightened level of uncertainty that would occur as a result of this law, this bill being passed.
Senator Olson.
Madam Chair and Ms. Pontius, would there be any kind of a little bit like what Senator Higgins was talking about, but a little bit differently, if we were to state our basis for the distinction in the law, you know, and said this is the rational basis we've determined for doing this, would that just be opening a can of worms or limiting potential any potential defenses we might have later, or would that put us in a better position, do you think?
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, you know, despite the fact that normally legislative findings are frowned upon, the one exception has usually been in cases where there's a concern about a constitutional challenge. So you could do something like that with very explicit findings. Now, obviously, the court's going to look to the record as well, you know, which you've, you know, had a discussion of today. But it doesn't hurt if, in a particular case, you can put something in as well, actually in the language of the bill.
Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair, it sounds like that's the kind of thing that shouldn't be written on the fly. But I think it would give me a little more comfort if we could put something like that in there, as Senator Olson suggested. Should we hold this over till the next committee hearing and give Ms. Pontius, Senator Latz, and Mr. Grunhofer a chance to work out some language that might solve the puzzle that we have right here?
So, will of the committee, you certainly can motion to table the bill if that's your desire.
Well, I was more throwing it out for some discussion.
Senator Latz?
If people think that's wise, I would make that, but I don't know what anybody else thinks.
Madam Chair, I think that would be helpful and would give some comfort to some of the senators, and I'm certainly willing to do that. So, I will certainly talk individually with some senators about that, too, to try to fashion language that would most clearly express the legislative intent here. There are some non-lawyers that are on the bill. Actually, David Hand is also co-author of the bill. So it's not only the lawyers that are interested in this policy question. But I'm certainly willing to do that, and I'd ask the committee to do that, give me the opportunity to put that language together.
Well, if the authors agreeable to that, why don't we table the discussion? Certainly the bill is in the committee, not going anywhere. We'll bring you back for the ultimate discussion on it. And I don't think we need a motion from the members, so the author has asked for that. So,
Madam Chair, if I might, before we do that, just while I'm thinking of one point I wanted to add, which is, and I think the committee has this information, but I'll just highlight it. I'm not sure if you have it. There are currently 14 states that have no statutory limits at all on their liability exposure. And there are another 6 states that have individual limits, but do not have occurrence or aggregate limits. Or at least states. That was the data as of November 2007. So a total of 20 states don't have any aggregate cap at all. Okay. So we would certainly not be alone. We'd be, it's roughly split in the country.
Madam Chair.
Thank you. Senator Higgins.
Would it be possible to find out more information about those states on whether they accommodate the local governments somehow differently? Maybe Mr. Grunhofer can help with that.
Absolutely. Sorry.
We'll make sure that information gets to committee members, and we'll make sure that we touch on that when we bring the bill back to the committee. Thank you, Senator Latz. I know that you've done a lot of work on this. Thank you for your input, Mr. Grunhofer, and members. That was a great discussion. Thank you very much for your thoughtfulness on the issue. And given that, the committee is adjourned.